Bob Green is responsible for some of my favorite books of the last few years. He's written so many that I've loved through the years, but in particular, a book he wrote back in 2006 called And You Know You Should Be Glad, A True Story of Lifelong Friendship, really hit me where I lived. It was just terrific writing. And then last year, he came out with a book called When We Get to Surf City, which was all about his going out on tour with Jan and Dean as they went from summer festival to state fair to various other places around the country. That book, by the way, came out in paperback in May. And now Bob is back with a new book, which is called Late Edition, A Love Story. It is not a romance between a man and a woman, or a man and a man, or a woman and a woman. It is a romance between a boy and a newspaper. That's what Bob did for pretty much his entire adult life, starting in high school, working as a writer for a newspaper, for various newspapers, in fact, through the years. He did it for decades, and now continues to publish his work in print in these terrific books. And I'm very happy to welcome him back to the show. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you. You started at 17 years old in your hometown of Columbus, Ohio, on a little paper called the City Journal.
The Citizen Journal.
The Citizen Journal.
The Columbus Citizen Journal. Actually, it was even a year before that. On the day President Kennedy was assassinated, I was in school with all my friends, and they announced it on the loudspeaker, and some people were crying, and some people had their heads down on the desk. And I still can't explain why, but I went back to the back of the classroom where there was a typewriter. I wrote about 500 words on what the class was going through, and I had a buddy take me downtown on the busiest news day since World War II. I went up to the mezzanine where the offices of the Columbus Citizen Journal, which is now dead, the newspaper, and I walked in and I said to the city editor, I wrote a story. And he looks up and here's this kid at the desk, and he says, we're kind of busy. The president has just been shot. And I said, I know, that's what the story's about. And little did I know that soon enough I would be working for him as a copy boy. And you're right, Late Edition, the reason I made the subtitle A Love Story is because it's very much what it's about. It's a part of American life that seems to be ending. I know all the controversy these days about the media and people. This wasn't the media. This was a hometown paper where, you know, blue-collar guys and women worked there. It was before Woodward and Bernstein. There was no glamour to it. There was no elitism or prestige. This is a bunch of misfits who got to come down to the paper every day and every day do it all over again. And I tried to get in this book just sort of draw a portrait about what that was like and what the magic of it was like before everything in the newspaper business grew so grim and dreary and scary.
And I want to talk about that later on, because that is such an important part of the perspective that we have to have on the story that you're writing about. But I want to go back to the beginning of that career of yours. And I actually do see some parallels with my radio career, because, you know, I started doing it when I was in high school as well. And, you know, I can remember the first time I walked into a big-time radio station, which wasn't really all that big-time. It was in the projection booth of a broken-down drive-in theater. And I walked in there and I saw these guys doing what they were doing, which was, you know, the same thing I had been doing in other places, but it was magical in a certain way. And then I remember the first time I got to do it myself, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, Bob. When you finally got the job on the Citizen Journal and they sent you out to do something, anything, Did you know what you were doing?
Well, I watched, and there was no training program.
Right.
And the first, you know, one of the things I got to do, and I think what, as you're talking, I think that's what I hope the magic of the book will be, which is that no matter what you grew up to do, and the people who are listening to us now, no matter what you grew up to do, if there's something you did that you absolutely loved, that's what this is about. It's about falling in love with a kid. Was something you want to do. I had to go out 5-6 times a day to buy coffee and sandwiches at a little Italian restaurant called Paoletti's next to the newspaper. And for a kid who was a little bit shy, that was a great thing, because I had to go around to the newsroom every day and ask every reporter, every sports writer, every editor, every photographer what kind of sandwich they want, what they want in their coffee. So I got to know them that way. And it might have seemed you know, pretty menial work, running to get coffee and sandwiches for people, but it let me get to know the reporters. And once, you talk about teaching yourself, the first time they sent me out to gather information on a fire, and I saw the building on fire, and I walked up the stairs, and the fireman sees me, and he says, "What are you doing in here?" And I said, I'm covering, I'm from the Citizen Journal. Here, I'm a kid. I'm from the Citizen Journal. I'm covering the, he says, "You don't cover a fire from inside, get out. Go back out to the street." Nobody had told me that you don't go into the building where the fire is. And I came back to the paper and I gave him the information, and the city editor said, where'd you get this colorful stuff from inside the building? I said, "Well, I went in there, and the fireman told me I'm not supposed to be in there." And the city editor smiled and said, "Yeah, don't do it again. Good stuff."
Now, among the things I know about you, Bob, is that when you were 17 years old, you fell in love with the newspaper. You were already in love with rock and roll, because we're talking about the time that the Beatles and the Stones and all the rest were changing the face of rock and roll in America. And you also, of course, being a teenage boy, had a passion for members of the opposite sex.
Well, that sort of got put on hold that summer because I was working late nights. It's one of the things I had to give up. It was the first summer I really got good at baseball. I was on a team called the Epsilons, and we were really good. And for the first two games of the season, you know, I was errorless in the field. Everything that was hit at me, I turned into an out.
Uh-huh.
And I was really looking forward to spending the summer that way. And then I was offered this job as a copy boy. And I realized that the running around, the cruising around with my friends at night, looking for whatever the night might bring, I might have to give it up. And at the time, actually, come to think of it, I'm sort of proud of myself for making the decision to do what I did, because I was having a great summer, and it looked like it was going to be even greater. And then I was told, "Do you want to come downtown and work on the mezzanine of this building for this newspaper that turned out to be a dying newspaper?" And I didn't even hesitate. I said, "Yeah."
Yeah. I'd love to do that. Yeah. I can understand that passion. But my question was, once you got to the point where you weren't just getting coffee, where you were actually a beat reporter and maybe your name was showing up in the newspaper, did that help you get girls?
It didn't apply. I got home at 1 in the morning every night. You know? although the sports, the late edition takes place over the span of about four or five years when I was a kid. I mean, I was still in college by the time I left to go to a bigger city. But I was allowed to cover stories for the sports section, and I was getting my name in the paper. And I used the byline at that point by Bob Green Jr., because my father's name is Robert Green.
Yep.
And I didn't want there to be any confusion in town. And we would go, I mean, to me, it was, I'd grown up reading these sports writers in the local paper, Kay Kessler and Tom Pastorius and Tom Keyes. And to me, you know, those names were better than Hemingway or Faulkner. You know, these were the sports writers for the Citizen Journal. And all of a sudden, I was having dinner with them every night at Paoletti's, before going back to our night shift. And there was a waitress named Thelma. And I remember one night she said to us at dinner over our Salisbury steak and peas, pot roast, she said to the real sports writers, "You know, Youngblood's getting his name more in the paper than you are." And I thought, "Oh, boy, I'm Youngblood, and I'm getting bylines."
Yeah.
And, of course, I looked around, and there was one sort of middle-aged sports writer, not as old as the others, and I realized a few years before he was probably Youngblood to Thelma, too, you know.
And he was just happy to pass it on, do you think?
Yeah, well, I don't know, but I was thrilled. Not only was I Youngblood, but I was getting my name in the paper, and she knew it.
What was, over the course of those 4 or 5 years that you were at the Columbus Citizen Journal, what was the biggest or most exciting story for you to cover?
Well, there was a riot at the Ohio Penitentiary. I mean, literally. And the Ohio Penitentiary in Columbus at the time is now gone. It was torn down. It was right, you know, 2 minutes from downtown. And so you could literally be there in a minute or two. And the Ohio National Guard and the Columbus Police and the Ohio Highway Patrol blew a hole in the wall of the prison, and they also dropped down through a hole they blew in the roof. And it was really like warfare in an American city in the middle of a summer afternoon.
Wow.
And the guards had been held hostage, and they rushed them out and took them over, I think it was to Mount Carmel Hospital downtown. And now, of course, if that happened, there'd be layers of, you know, media, what do you call them, media specialists and hospital public relations. But we just went in there and we got to talk to him before the cops. And just, you know, to be a kid and to be in the middle of that kind of excitement, and you just realize, and I, even as we're talking, Paul, I realize the details of the stories covered, while interesting at the moment, those come and go. But the sound that I remember from those days and nights, it was the sound of laughter. Because it was a time back then when there was such looseness and laughter in American city rooms. Things had not turned grim and self-examinatory. These were a bunch of, I mentioned before that they seemed like a bunch of misfits.
Yeah.
These were men and women who, had there been no such thing as newspaper work, I don't know what they would have done with their lives.
Mm.
And I came to realize that for a group of misfits, I had never felt like I fit in more with people in my life. It was like this room that's now gone, was waiting for me all my life.
But in the dedication to your book, Bob, you say, quote, "This is for those who, despite everything, are walking through the front doors of a newspaper building today and with hope in their hearts, applying for their first job." If you met one of those people who was thinking, "I'm going to go into the newspaper business now," in 2009, what would you tell them as a newspaper veteran?
I'd tell them to do it, and I'd tell them to do it knowing everything I know. Who knows what's going to happen? I mean, it's pretty clear that the printed newspapers are going away. But my thinking is that it's just such a wonderful way to live your life and make your living that if someone even gets to do it for a year or two, they should. I was thinking, you know, during the break, little moments. There was a night that summer when I was, you know, when I was a kid working on the sports desk, and the phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was just such a glorious way to answer the phone with that one word, sports. I mean, is there a better word, sports? Is there just a better way to answer a telephone? So one night I pick up the phone, sports, and I hear a voice say, "To whom am I speaking?" And I said, "It's Bob Green." He said, "Now that's no way to answer a telephone, is it?" Now, I've seen your byline in the paper. It's Bob Green Jr., isn't it? I said, "Yes." He said, "Now, I've met your parents. Are your parents Robert and Phyllis Green of Bexley?" I said, "Yes." And the person said, "Now, I know they're fine people, and I know they didn't raise you to answer a phone without announcing yourself. You should always tell the person on the other end who it is.
Wow.
You don't want to embarrass your parents, do you?" And I said, "No, sir." He says, "All right. Now, this is Woody Hayes. May I speak to Tom Pastoria?" And it was indeed the legendary Woody Hayes, the coach of the Ohio State football team. He wanted to talk to one of the sports writers.
Wow.
And it was just the localness of that, the localness of feeling, you know, you were all, it'd be like if you were working at the Post-Dispatch or the old Globe Democrat and you picking up the phone and getting a lecture from Stan Musial.
Yeah.
You know, you felt like you were in the newspaper office, and you're in the hub of the town, and look who's calling, Woody Hayes.
Now, if that were me, Bob, I would have thought two things. One, well, I just got a lecture from a guy who I respect, and on the other hand, he knows who I am.
Right. That was the thing. It was just, if you were in the, see, that's what I was trying to say. If you were in the newspaper in your town, if you had a byline, you knew that everybody in town was reading it, even Woody Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I hate to say it, but there are stories in the local papers in most cities that the reporters can't count on being read. It's because we've just been so bombarded with other ways to get our information, as you said. I mean, you've got your Facebook, you've got your Twitter.
And I did, by the way, just tweet about you being on the show here today and plug your book online for you.
Well, I appreciate it. But there was a time, Paul, and what time wasn't very long ago, when I would have said, "Well, you tweet me, you would have, you know, smack me." You know, this has all happened so fast. I mean, we've known each other a while.
Yeah.
And this is very recently you can do that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And what it means, of course, is that people who want to know what you have to say or think have a million ways to get it.
Yep.
And it just seems now like the newspaper printed on big sheets of paper is fading. And
yep.
We can't stop it, and it's the passage of time. But what I try to do in the book is to somehow conjure up the romance one more time.
Now, let's talk about speed for just a second here, because I've always worked in the live broadcast medium where everything I say goes out, can't take it back, somebody's going to hear it, it's done. I think of it, I say it, it's out there. Or if I write something and read it, it's live, it's out there. You worked in a medium and at a time where deadlines were once a day, and you actually had time to think. But now for people who are in the same business as you, who are in the news and information gathering business, there's no such thing as a deadline anymore, because even if you work on a newspaper, that newspaper has a website, and there's still the competitive pressure to get that story out there. What does that do to the ability to think?
It's not only is it harder to do, but my guess is that it's become devalued. What you want is those few quick paragraphs now. We lived by the clock in the city room. There was a big round clock up near the city desk. And you're right, we had two deadlines, but they were, you know, for different editions, but that was it. And it was almost like we were putting a present together for the people of the town. It was like every day we were, you know, cooking them breakfast. We would work late at night and it would be served on their doorstep the next morning. Well, that's you know, as you mentioned, that has been outmoded. United Press International, the old classic wire service, the second wire service of the Associated Press, they used to have a slogan, and it was just swashbuckling slogan. It was deadline every minute, and that was so exciting to think that UPI had a deadline every minute. Well, now, who doesn't?
Yep.
You know, everybody does. The fact is, we are still on the air, and whatever you just put online and Twittered, it's out there already,
right?
And we're still here.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be generations till we figure out the profound change that this is. But there was something about that sort of, you know, naively innocent age when you did this thing once a day and you knew the people. In most towns, people subscribed to a morning paper and an afternoon paper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had to have two papers in their house. Are we better or worse off? I don't know. But that's not the point. The point is, that was a time that's going, and I sort of tried to get it down on paper.
The book is called Late Edition. Bob, I'd love to spend another segment with you. Can you hang on?
Absolutely.
I appreciate it. This is a terrific read, as is everything that Bob has put in print. Bob Green, Late Edition, A Love Story. More coming up in just a moment here on the Big 550 KTRS. Back now to my conversation with Bob Green, the author of Late Edition, A Love Story, a book he wrote about his earliest days in the newspaper game, where he started out as a copy boy for the Columbus Citizen Journal, then worked his way up to the sports desk and did lots of other stuff for them over the course of 4 or 5 years, then left there to go to Chicago, where I think you first worked for the Sun-Times and then for the Trib. Is that right?
Right. And then now I've been writing, starting with the presidential campaign, which Governor Palin was a part of. I was with her in St. Louis for CNN.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been traveling the country writing columns for CNN. And, you know, it's quicker, and it's on those screens all over the world. But I was just thinking, as you mentioned the news about Governor Palin, we sure didn't have to wait till tomorrow morning to read that in the paper, did we?
No, we didn't. It's today's news, and you get it today, and you get it instantly.
And by tomorrow morning, when the newspapers print it, it's going to seem like old news.
You know, I turn to page 104 of your book, Late Edition, here, and I quote you because I thought this was such a terrific paragraph that was so prescient in its nostalgic look at what would become your future. That sounded so convoluted, but if I just read this, everybody would understand what it was. Here's the paragraph. My father would put down the Dispatch, that was the local paper. My father would put down the Dispatch each night a minute before Walter Cronkite, before the news arrived in our home. Had I been smarter, had I been paying proper attention, I might have sensed what this signified. In retrospect, Bob, what did that signify?
It signified that already in 1964, 65, 66, 67, our parents' generation was, and our grandparents' generation was sensing a sea change, was sensing that the newspaper that was sitting there was not the news. It was something else. My father would say the phrase. He put down the newspaper in our home, and he said, "I have to go watch the news."
Mm-hmm.
The news was on, but during that last break, I was thinking again, Paul. The first story I ever had in a newspaper. It just seemed like such a wonderful thing to have. I was assigned to call every police and fire department to ask about the emergency runs. Because back then, you may recall, newspapers ran those. They ran the little agate type of every time the police or fire went out.
Yep.
And so I would have to call all the local departments every day. And I would type them up. They'd be in that little tiny type. And then one Sunday I called up, and I heard about a guy who had been hospitalized because a golf ball had exploded and had injured his eye. And I thought, you know, this could be a story. And so I didn't want to tell this, you know, I was 17. I didn't want to tell the city editor about it because he might assign it to a real reporter. And I didn't want to put it in the little agate tiny type as a one-sentence thing because then who knew it was there?
Yeah.
So I called the guy's house, and his wife answered, and I said who I was from the Columbus Citizen Journal in 17 and what happened. And she said that her husband had always wondered what was inside a liquid center golf ball.
Ugh.
So he took it down to the basement and tried to saw it open, and it had exploded, and the goo got into his eye.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down there, and I wrote like a three-paragraph story, and I was just so excited, and I handed it to the city editor, and I saw it go to the copy desk, and I saw the copy editor write on top of it, "Golf ball fights back." And it was my... That dinner hour, you know, they used to have these long galley sheets that they would put on the hooks in the composing room. I went up there and I spent my whole dinner hour just looking at that story, an actual newspaper type. He crunched it down to two paragraphs. I mean, editors being editors. But I just, and the next morning I got up at 6 in the morning and I heard the paper hit the front stoop and I opened it up and I went through it and I didn't see the story. And I was just so downfall. And then I looked one more time. I went through it again page by page, and there at the very bottom of the obit page, there it was, "Golf ball fights back."
Yeah.
And I'd written it. You know, it was just such a huge deal to be in the local newspaper. And my name wasn't on it. I mean, I had to convince my parents I'd really written it, but that just seems to be something, you know, in distant memory now.
And here's the great thing about what would happen today if you did that story, because there's still somebody writing that story. But today, it gets linked to on FARC.com, and then I find it on FARC, and I talk about it on my show. Even though I'm nowhere near Columbus, Ohio, I can have that story the next day because you told it. And that's one thing I want to ask you about here, Bob. One of the things that dies when newspapers die, is having somebody to tell those stories. Even when we find news online, there still had to be somebody going and covering that story or calling that golf ball widow up and digging up that story.
And you have to pay someone to do it. I mean, I was being paid $58.50 a week, but I was still getting that $58.
So what
to
happens?
Be there as a copy boy. I don't know. And the other, well, those stories don't get found. Or somebody tells you about them on a blog, but you don't really know, you know.
Yeah.
The idea of the gatekeeper, they're used to, you know, you had to get past an editor. Somebody had to say it was okay to put your words on the printing press.
Yeah.
Now, that's gone away. But I wonder if a kid today, you know, because if a kid today has a thought, he gets online, he puts it on a message board or on a blog or you know, on Facebook.
Yep.
And it's out there for the world to see.
It's
a profound change, and my question to myself is, does that kid who takes it for granted that any thought he has can go out to the world, is it as precious to him as it was when I got up before dawn and waited to hear that thump of the newspaper on the front stoop, hoping against hope that my two-paragraph story was in there, because that meant someone had said it was good enough. And up to that point, it was the most wonderful day in my life. And I just wonder whether today, when there is no gatekeeper, when anything you want you can put out there worldwide, I wonder if the thrill is still there.
Last thing I want to ask you about, as a veteran of the newspaper business for so long, do you think that your industry made a mistake giving it away for free online, thus killing itself?
The biggest mistake, you know, Paul, I remember I would be going to O'Hare Airport, and I would see these big billboards that the newspaper put up near O'Hare saying, you know, .com, you know, where you could read the paper for free. And I'm thinking in Chicago, they're saying to people, you can either, I think it was 50 or 75 cents at that point for the morning paper, you can either go out in the snow and trudge down your driveway or go to the cornered box and pay 50 cents or 75 cents and take your overcoat back off and read the paper inside for money, or it's free. Which will you choose?
Yeah.
And then the bosses, the publishers, seemed to be shocked when the circulation started going down. They were begging people to take their product for free on a computer, and then they scratched their heads and say, you know, we're losing circulation.
Yeah.
It was mutual assured destruction, and it would have happened eventually, but these bosses, you know, you say to yourself, well, they must know what they're doing. They must have a business plan here. And look what happened. They were fighting each other to give it away free first. And now all of a sudden they're saying, well, we're going to have to start charging for content. People aren't going to pay. You've given it to them for free. It was a decision that's going to be the end of an industry.
Yep. Unfortunately, I think you're right. The book is called Late Edition. It is a wonderful book, as are all of the things Bob writes. A great story about his beginnings in that industry that we now see on the wane. And if you like terrific American journalism and you like good American writing, you're not going to do much better than Bob Green. The book, Late Edition, will officially be published next Tuesday, July 7th, but you can order it now on Amazon.com or use the link on my website, harrisonline.com. Good luck with the book, Bob. It's always a pleasure.
Paul, I'll talk to you soon.